The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Robert J. Stegman presiding.
Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Good afternoon, counsel. First case this afternoon, excuse me, is 423-1181, people of the state of Illinois versus Keon E. Spiller. I'll ask counsel to identify yourself. Counsel for the appellant, please identify yourself.
Good morning, Your Honor, or good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Madison Heckel on behalf of Mr. Spiller.
Thank you, and counsel for the appellee.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is David Manchin. I'm with the appellate prosecutors on behalf of the state.
Thank you, Ms. Heckel, on behalf of the appellant, and may proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. And may it please the court, I am from the Office of the State Appellate Defender representing Mr. Spiller. Mr. Spiller was convicted of unlawful possession of a controlled substance, as well as unlawful possession of cannabis with the intent to deliver. Police had searched his car based solely on the smell of cannabis, and they found within that search a bag that contained a small amount of ecstasy, as well as some cannabis found in dispensary-like containers. After trial counsel failed to file a motion to suppress the evidence and the state failed to prove that Mr. Spiller knew what was within the bag and that he possessed it, he was sentenced to 9 years, 1 year short of the maximum sentence. I first plan to discuss the issue of reasonable doubt, but I anticipate we will also discuss trial counsel's failure to file a motion to suppress the evidence based on the supplemental motions.
Yes, counsel. As a matter of fact, that's where I would like to begin my questions pertaining to your argument. You're raising ineffective assistance of counsel, and you're familiar with the Strickland standard. It talks about essentially a two-pronged test where you must show that counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. And second, that a reasonable probability exists that for defendant's deficient performance, the result would have been different. In your brief, you're asking us to follow People versus Page, where the First District sent this case before it back down for a hearing to see on a motion to suppress because the court thought that. There was the argument was defense counsel had failed to file a motion, and the court thought that might be merit to it and sent the case back down while keeping jurisdiction. In Page, the First District also wrote, the trial counsel's decision regarding whether to file a motion to suppress generally involves a matter of trial strategy is entitled to great deference, and to overcome the trial strategy presumption, the defendant must show a reasonable probability that the motion would have succeeded and the outcome of the trial would have been different. And further, the court wrote, counsel's failure to file a motion to suppress does not demonstrate incompetent representation when it turns out the motion would have been futile. So, when you're asking us to follow Page because you are claiming that this was ineffective assistance of counsel and we should follow their example. So my first question is this. When addressing whether trial counsel was ineffective for not filing a motion to suppress, shouldn't this court and on remand, if we were to do that, the trial court, inquire into why defense counsel may have decided not to file that motion. Some possibilities, none of which are revealed in this record, because as this court has written in the past, it's difficult to speculate about what counsel knew or what the record may show when no motion to suppress was filed, so we don't know. There are some possibilities, such as this. Maybe counsel, and we, I think, have to presume, I think that's part of the process, that defense counsel at the trial level understood the law and understood, the facts of the case. So the question is, would trial counsel think that the motion wouldn't be successful? Would he decline perhaps to file a motion to suppress because of plea negotiations? I don't know if you're familiar with trial practice, but the three judges in this panel understand that that's not an infrequent occurrence. In routine cases like this, where the defense attorney is told by the state, if you're going to file a motion to suppress, we have to litigate it. Forget about any plea deals at that point. We're just going to try it. Or what about the possibility of a likelihood that a good faith exception would apply if the defense counsel were to raise that issue? What about these matters? Are these things that this court and the trial court and remand would have to be addressing?
Thank you, Your Honor. At the time of Mr. Spiller's trial, there was a split in the fourth and third districts about whether or not the motion to suppress would have been successful. I would note that at the time that Mr. Spiller's car was searched, two cases within the fourth district are, had or two situ scenarios had happened where a motion to suppress based on the smell of cannabis were both successful. So it was very much in the air. In the as to be known that
I'm not
cannabis
sure I've
is
understood. You're saying that the Fourth District had upheld motions to suppress
to
because
clarify
the
a
smell of
motion
cannabis wasn't enough?
at the time that Mr. Spiller's car was searched, motions to suppress had been successful. They were later determined on appeal that they were later reversed.
Well, but the
But
Fourth
so
District had held that the smell of cannabis was enough, had it not?
the Fourth District had, you are correct about that. I believe you wrote Molina yourself. But
Yes. And this is a case in McLean County, so that decision would have applied to McLean County, would it not?
Molina specifically was raw cannabis, as is of note in this case. We do not know if the cannabis smelled was raw or burnt. I would suggest that the police smelled burnt cannabis because almost immediately upon attending the car, the police asked Mr. Spiller, had anyone been smoking? But it was unclear. So this would have been clarified in a motion to suppress. And so if it
Now,
were.
counsel should be presumed to know the facts of the case and should be presumed to know Molina. And
Correct.
if counsel believes it's smell of raw cannabis, then Molina would apply, wouldn't it?
Yes, but nothing in the record indicates that counsel did know that. Nothing in the case
Yeah,
indicates
but
the
you
state.
are, so we should presume counsel didn't know it? Isn't that contrary to how we're supposed to address it? Let me go. Earlier this year, I want to quote something to you. Earlier this year, this court wrote the following on this point. With regard to four presumptions to be made concerning claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. First, we presume that counsel's actions or inaction are the product of sound trial strategy. Second, we presume that counsel knew the law and how to apply it. Third, we presume that counsel fully investigated potential defenses and knew the facts of the case. And fourth, we presume that counsel's actions and representations in the trial court were ethically sound. That means we should presume the counsel understood Molina and understood the facts of his own case. And if this was raw cannabis, that would be a reason not to file a motion to suppress, would it not?
Except Molina had been already accepted by the Supreme Court to be heard, and Redmond had somewhat contradicting in the fact that it was burnt cannabis instead of raw. But so counsel should have known that this issue was not fully clarified by the Illinois Supreme Court and
But
then
is that the
preserve
standard for ineffective assistance of counsel? Let me go back and mention again. The standard in Strickland, 40 years old, and the Supreme Court of the United States hasn't changed it, is counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. Isn't your argument now before this court that counsel is required to preserve an issue merely for the possibility that it might later become meritorious by a subsequent change in the law? Isn't that your argument?
I would argue that it was unclear whether or not it would have been meritorious, particularly because nothing in the
Is
record
that
shows.
yes, counsel, to my question? I'll repeat my question. Isn't your argument essentially that defense counsel is required to preserve an issue, like filing a motion to suppress in this case, merely for the possibility that it might later become meritorious by a subsequent change in the law?
I think what you are stating is too broad, as I presume you would agree.
Well, at the moment that the issue is before the McLean County Circuit Court, There was no merit to that motion.
But it had
Isn't
already
that
been
correct?
it had already been appointed or approved to be heard before the Supreme Court, so it's unclear
And
whether
so
it
that's, there's no basis for the trial court, had a motion been filed and heard, to grant the motion based upon a PLA having been granted. The trial court would have to follow Molina, would it not?
The trial had it been clear that the cannabis was raw, yes, which in this case it is not.
So the trial, so that motion would have been denied.
If it was clear the cannabis was raw, yes.
Okay, so is there any case law that stands for the proposition that defense counsel must add clairvoyance to the standards of deciding whether or not to file a motion to suppress? That is, even though there's no basis to grant the motion now, because the trial court in McLean County would have to deny it, maybe the Supreme Court would reverse that judgment, and maybe then the defendant would be able to preserve that issue. Is there any case law that so holds?
The Supreme Court of the United States has held that that it is, if something is fundamental to the case, counsel is supposed to be aware of that area of law. And so counsel would know that this was an issue that was pending because it had not been directly addressed by the Supreme Court in any fashion since the legalization of cannabis in 2020.
So the possibility of a change is enough to render counsel's decision not to file a motion to suppress as coming, falling below an objective standard of reasonableness within Strickland?
I think the difference is whether or not it is going to be directly heard by the Supreme Court already. At that point in time, counsel was very aware that the law of cannabis had been changed, that the Supreme Court and appellate courts were going to have to consider issues they had not considered prior to 2020. So it is up to counsel to clarify the record and maintain these issues on appeal for any chance of success on this. There's no reason that an attorney should not pursue the possibility of suppression of the evidence.
Regarding the Page case again, the First District decided to take this case and send it back to the trial court for a hearing on the merits of the motion to suppress. But doesn't that presume, isn't the First District by doing that presuming that the first prong of the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel has been established, namely the counsel's performance fell below an objective standard? Because to be clear, following your argument, maybe we should send this case back. If we were to do that, wouldn't the first question be to address the first prong and ask defense counsel, who is counsel at trial, why didn't you file a motion to suppress? Because perhaps counsel had good strategic reasons not to, and that would defeat the motion, wouldn't it?
Well, in this case, because it is not clear whether or not the cannabis is raw or burnt, if it was raw, as you've said, Molina would rule and it would not have been meritorious. But if it were burnt, there is a very strong likelihood, based on People v. Redmond, that it would be successful. And so therefore, we need to determine whether or not the cannabis is raw or burnt before we can determine whether or not counsel was ineffective based on what you are saying. And so
that's, another
this would
question
save
about
us.
This, as we're evaluating whether counsel's action was appropriate in not filing a motion to suppress, even if it were the case that there was a change in the law, this court recently found an opinion in which we reiterated that absent police misconduct, the exclusionary rule does not apply. What was the police misconduct in this case?
I'm sorry, you're saying that absent the, you're, are you going back
the,
to the
decision we wrote, we reiterated, was absent police misconduct, the exclusionary rule does not apply. Given the facts of this case, what was the police misconduct which would justify the application of the exclusionary rule?
I would argue that the police should have been aware, because of the change in the law, that the smell of cannabis alone was not necessarily sufficient to establish probable cause.
So that's police misconduct? They couldn't rely upon a decision of the appellate court in deciding to conduct this search?
If this Molina did not exist at the time of the search, Molina came out in 2022, and the search Molina was decided in November of 2022, over 6 months after the search occurred. So at the time, there was no appellate decision saying whether or not there was probable cause.
Well, given Molina's decision, wouldn't this be a good faith exception from the police? Wouldn't that
Well,
apply in these circumstances?
I would argue that the good faith exception is not something that the defense counsel should have considered because that is the state's burden to meet. The defense is not supposed to do the state's job for them. The defense is supposed to file motions that it believes to be meritorious, and then the state would establish whether or would argue whether or not that good faith existed.
Okay, I've taken up too much of your time as it is. You may continue on the one.
I apologize. You want?
I said, I apologize for taking up so much of your time. You may continue otherwise. Go ahead.
You are, no worries. Thank you. Going to the reasonable doubt argument, I would argue that the state did not meet its burden in proving that Mr. Spiller had knowledge or possession of the cannabis or of the contraband. And most importantly, the state did not meet its burden of proving that Spiller had the intent to deliver the cannabis.
So if I may,
Yes.
well, we're focused on the issue of knowledge and possession. I guess my question is, when we talk about your argument that there was, and if I've got this correct, no circumstantial evidence to support the state's theory that the defendant knew the contents of the Gucci bag.
Correct.
However, I guess my question is, doesn't contraband found in a vehicle under the control of the defendant give rise to an inference of knowledge and possession by him? Secondly, hasn't that been found to be sufficient in and of itself to sustain a conviction?
Status of the of Mr. Spiller as the owner and driver of the vehicle does not necessarily mean that he is in possession of everything within the area and not and does not indicate that he necessarily knew of everything within the vehicle. There have been cases that have shown that the driver knew what was within one area of the vehicle but not another, and that the driver did not know of everything within that the passengers of the car had. You're correct that it does give rise to the inference, but it is not dispositive, and there's no additional circumstantial evidence to support that inference in this case.
But he did at one point possess the bag and there was cannabis near the gear shift, correct?
There was not sufficient evidence supposedly to show that he possessed the cannabis near the gear shift because he was not charged with that. And then you are correct that he was seen with the bag before the party, but the officer that viewed him seeing with the bag did not see anything that occurred during the party. He says he does not recall seeing Mr. Spiller during the party, and there's a lot that could have happened between the time when he had the bag and when Mr. Banks had the bag getting back into the car, which leaves significant room for reasonable doubt that the cannabis was already in there or whether anything was brought into the bag once Mr. Banks took possession of the bag. And the state tries to say that there was joint possession between Mr. Banks and Mr. Spiller, but there is no evidence showing that Mr. Spiller had immediate and exclusive control of this bag and that Mr. Banks intended to share control of this bag. It was not within arm's reach. It was behind him, so he would not be able to reach it while he was driving. And there was no indication that he made no indication when he was pulled over that he was trying to tell Mr. Banks to put the bag away, hide it, or anything of that sort. If that is everything, I will retain the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors. Justice Steigman,
Mr.
I'm
Steigman,
sorry.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
Justice Steigman, I cannot hear you as well.
Still not. So, Justice Steigman, I cannot hear you at all right now. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you
Okay.
fine. Just a
Okay.
moment.
Justice
Now
Steigman,
we
I
can
can
hear
hear you
you.
now.
Okay.
You can hear me?
I can hear
Yes.
you now, yes, sir.
Okay, well, so hopefully that was a minor glitch. I'm sorry about it. So, Mr. Manchin, at this time, you may proceed, sir.
Okay, thank you, Your Honors. I will address first the question of competency of counsel. And as Your Honor noted, there is a presumption that of that his decision was a reasonable tactical one or strategic one. At the time of this case, the Supreme Court and the Fourth District had said the smell of cannabis alone is sufficient for probable cause. There was no distinction that I'm aware of or can recall between burnt or raw cannabis as far as the smell providing basis for a search prior to Redmond. So the counsel at the time, with in full possession of all the discovery materials, none of which is before this court, made a reasonable decision that, hey, given the law in the Fourth District, a motion to suppress was going to fail. Because if there's a split in the district, the trial courts are required to follow the decision in the district in which they're sitting. The Fourth District, in roll prior to this case, back in 2021, had said that the smell of cannabis alone. And then back in 85, the Supreme Court had said that the smell of cannabis alone. That was the prevailing law, so that it was reasonable for counsel to say, hey, there's no reason to file, it's going to fail. And I think, Justice Steinman, your point is correct that counsel is requiring clairvoyance on the part of trial counsel, not only to anticipate that the law might change, not only that the Supreme Court is going to address the issue, but he's got to anticipate and predict the exact outcome. I don't think that the decision in Redmond is a foregone conclusion that the Supreme Court was going to rule the way they did, because the Supreme Court does state in there many times that the smell of cannabis, even under the current law, can give rise to inferences that the current laws are being violated. But then they just went on because to say that nevertheless the smell alone is not enough. Well, here, we don't know that the smell alone was the basis for the search, because counsel, with full knowledge of all the information, made the decision not to file this motion to suppress. So we have a lot of information that's not available, including, as Justice Steigman says, counsel's reasoning why he didn't. So if this ever gets sent back, you have to have first address the question. What was counsel's thinking? Why did he not file it? And then you get into the question of, okay, was that is he was there prejudice because of that? And in Gayden, the Supreme Court said that no, when the defendants files a motion to claims on appeal that counsel's ineffective. And the record's insufficient to resolve the issue, you don't send it back for a evidentiary hearing on that matter. It's left to this post-conviction proceedings. So that this
You
case,
disagree with People versus Page?
well, Page conflicts with Gayden, which is my problem with Page. Page said, we're going to send it back because it's unfair to require the defendant to file a post-conviction petition, because by the time this all gets resolved to the post-conviction petition, he could be out of jail anyway. That was the reason that the Page court said, we'll send it back for a hearing to determine whether for a full evidentiary hearing. Well, in Gayden, the court says, no, the fear this case is going, the
Thank you.
time's going to elapse is not a basis to send it back for a hearing, that the guy's remedy is post-conviction. And in that case, the defendant could not file a post-conviction petition because he'd fully served his time, was out of jail by the time the case was decided. So to say that remand is required by Page, I think conflicts with Gayden. But if it does get sent back, it does not get sent back simply for the is it raw or burnt cannabis. It has to go back for the full circumstances of the search, starting with counsel's decision-making thing. Why did he not file? He could, he has many reasons not to. The governing law was that the smell was enough. He could have felt, okay, it's a waste of time to file it. There's also the problem of good faith. While counsel suggests that the state's attorney is required to bring it up, when you're trying to decide whether to file the motion, you don't just look at your side of the case. You look at, okay, what can the state prove and what can the state argue? And if is the state's argument going to be accepted by the trial court, if it's if the anticipated response to my motion is going to be good faith, the trial court's going to rule against me on that basis, so I'm just not going to bother. So again, there's no the reasoning. It's a reasonable tactical decision as of the time of this case for counsel not to file a motion to suppress.
Counsel, there was another point I raised, and I don't recall seeing any case law on it. But on the question of tactical judgment by defense counsel, I remember back from my time when I had honest work as a trial judge, as I like to put it, when I recall seeing instances where the defense counsel forewent filing motions, especially motions to suppress that would require a lot of time and effort to respond to, and when the motion may have been perhaps a long reach to begin with, because the prosecutor's office said, look, if you're going to make us do that, then we're just going to go to trial and forget about trying to resolve this case on a plea agreement because I've already had to try the case. It seems to me that as to tactical judgments, especially in a case like this where we have some case law already suggesting the motion is not likely to prevail, to be well received, that the prospect of plea negotiations, which we don't know on this record, would never know, any discussion had, would be an important factor. Are you aware of any cases that have dealt with this? I'm not.
The closest thing I'm aware of is cases where the defendant pleads guilty and forgoes the motion to suppress as part of the plea agreement itself. But as far as any discussions, as far as counsel's competency based on ongoing negotiations, I've not seen anything like that either. No, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
But again, that does go to the question of was counsel ineffective or was did it fall below a reasonable level of representation not to file a motion to suppress at the time of this trial based on the prevailing law, which meant he was going to lose, and based upon the expectation that if I file it, the state's going to argue that the officers were acting in good faith. Based upon that prevailing law, there, it, and to say the officers were not acting in good faith because there's a split in the districts, is asking a little bit much of the average police officer on the street. The especially when the last time the Supreme Court had dealt with the issue, they had said, "Yeah, the smell is enough." And in the recent cases, we're not going to get into the weeds as to whether the changes of the law require a different standard as far as smell of cannabis. So, given the state of the law at that time, and given the lack of a clear record here as to why, whether the motion to suppress would be successful under Redmond. Because we don't know that. Counsel says that what happened at the park cannot be considered as far as this search of the car, but I submit it could be well be. If the police see drug dealing in the park, they see defendant's co-defendant passenger buying or selling drugs. If they know the defendant is a drug dealer, these are all questions that we don't know. We do know that one of the officers knew the defendant. How he knows him was excluded from the record. That was how he recognized the defendant and saw him carrying the Gucci bag that contained the drugs that he was charged with.
Picking up
So,
on that point, that also reminds me that the record doesn't show what the police knew, and the record doesn't show if a motion to suppress has been filed, what evidence the state might have been able to present in support of it. The defense argues appropriately that, gee, the cops just said they stopped the car because of tinted windows. Well, that's what they said at the time to the defendant, and I'm sure that was a factor. Maybe they had other things going on, other reasons that absent a motion to suppress, they didn't volunteer and maybe wasn't going to come out until such time as a motion to suppress had been filed and the prosecutor would gather the police and say, what all did you know? Tell us about what you saw and to what extent that would have justified a stop, even a Terry stop, as opposed to even a search. Would that be correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's why I was in my brief, I was suggesting that this court could just duck the issue entirely and say we're not going to decide whether or not counsel is ineffective simply because there's not enough here. And as in Gaydon, require the defendant to file the post-conviction petition. But I suggest that on this record, given the state of the law, that defendant cannot meet the first prong of counsel's performance, that it was not unreasonable at the time of this trial not to file a motion to suppress, unless counsel is supposed to predict not only that the Supreme Court is going to address the issue, but correctly predict which way the court's going to rule. And the case law says that there is no such duty of clairvoyance.
Yeah, that's speaking about post-conviction petition. And one of the differences between Page and a post-conviction petition, if we were to affirm, and let's say this matter is going to be addressed in a post-conviction petition, raising ineffective assistance of counsel, that'd be the two-pronged requirement defense would have to establish. And one of the prongs, we'd have to put defense counsel on the witness stand and say, what were you thinking? What did you know? You didn't file a
when
motion
did you
to
know
suppress.
It?
Why not? And
right.
What my problem with the Page court is that stage, the first prong inquiry is completely eliminated. The Page court assumes apparently that this is an appropriate inquiry. Go right to stage two, the second prong inquiry, to find out whether or not the motion would have been granted.
That's correct. With
anything
respect,
further, Mr. Manchin?
Not on the question of ineffective assistance, but if the court has questions about the reasonable doubt argument, I'll entertain them, or otherwise I can just stand on my brief. I will note that the defendant was identified as carrying the Gucci bag. The standard of review is take all the evidence in the light most favorable to the state and determine whether any reasonable trier of fact could determine guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't do a point-by-point discussion of every item of evidence and every inference and draw every inference in favor of the defendant.
Are you
defendant
suggesting that it's reasonable for the jury to infer that the defendant knew what was in the bag he was carrying?
Yes, I think it's perfectly reasonable. I don't know, unless we're going to say that the jury has to speculate that the defendant gave it to somebody who gave it to somebody who gave it to somebody who put the drugs in it, who gave it to somebody else who gave it back to the defendant. That's not the standard reasonable doubt. Can you come up with a scenario that proves the defendant innocent? And that seems to be defendant's argument here is that there are other inferences that could have been drawn and should have been drawn, therefore we need to reverse. And that's simply not the standard.
The defendant did not testify in this case, so we didn't hear his disclaiming any knowledge of the contents of the Gucci bag.
That's correct. And as far as the intent to deliver, again, there's they could infer the intent to deliver from the amount of the cannabis, which was in excess of what you can possess for legal use, the presence of two types of drugs, the presence of other drugs in the car that he's not charged with. And I submit that the fact he's not charged with those other drugs does not mean anything other than that the state decided, okay, we're going to charge him with the Gucci bag because that's the easier thing to prove because we saw, had him in actual possession of the Gucci bag at one point. It's an easier case to make than drugs on the floor and the glove compartment or by the stick shift. So they have the amount of money he's got in his possession, which the officers said was consistent with drug dealing, and they have the two weapons in the car. So most of the factors generally relied on for showing intent are present in this case. Defendant has suggested that two of the factors should no longer be considered, namely possession of money and the manner of packaging. I say they still can be considered. They cannot be excluded from the list. It's just what kind of inferences can be drawn from that. And that goes to the weight of the evidence, not the because if you have a cannabis in a tied off corner of a baggie, it's more likely to show intent to deliver than the cannabis stock in the car. So you have to consider the cache and manner of packaging. And note here that the technician that tested the drugs noted that the cannabis here was in California, had California tax tags on it, which means that defendant or somebody had to go to California to get the drugs. Which would seem to me to be an indication of intent to deliver, because I don't know how many people make a trip out to California just to get drugs, just to use for their personal basis. And I don't, for an average juror, I don't know how many jurors they would know would expect very many people to be going to California to get drugs for personal use when you can go to the corner dispensary. So there's no other questions. I will stand on my brief. Thank you, Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Heckel, on behalf of the appellant, you may make your rebuttal argument.
Thank you. First and foremost, in response directly to the California tax, there is nothing in the record that indicates whether or not that the California tax means that cannabis came from California. There's nothing in the record that says how dispensaries label cannabis in Illinois versus California or whatnot. So what the state is saying is merely speculative. To redirect back to the ineffective assistance argument, at the time of this case, while Hill did not to overturn Stout, it specifically said that it was not considering the new legalization of cannabis because the fact pattern in Hill occurred before legalization. Further, Rowell that the state cites was also a fact pattern that occurred before legalization. So neither of those were considering legalization and its effects. The Supreme Court did not specifically say that it was still probable cause. It was very much still up in the air at the time because one does not need to be clairvoyant to know that if cannabis is no longer illegal, that it may have an impact on probable cause determination. Defense counsel is meant to be zealous and to fight adamantly for their client. in the way that is going to best be supportive of their client's case. And in this case, the best outcome would be to suppress the evidence, which would only occur if counsel had filed a motion to suppress. And further, had we not raised this issue, state in a different case could argue that we should have challenged this exact issue because it was an issue before the Supreme Court. It does not require clairvoyance to know that the law may change when the Supreme Court has already said they will specifically address a question. The state also mentioned that we do not know that the smell alone was the reason for the search, but I would point to the record where the police told Spiller specifically they were searching his car because of the smell of cannabis. They wrote in their arrest reports that they were searched the car based on the smell of cannabis, and police testified at trial that they searched the car based on the smell of cannabis. It doesn't make sense why counsel or why the police would not put that in either their police report or at trial if there was another reason why they decided to search the car. Further, police testified at trial that he did not see anything occur during the party. While there may be facts missing from the record because they weren't brought out through the litigation, the police officer specifically testified that he did not recall seeing anything occur during the party with Mr. Spiller. So it is known from the record that he did not witness any sort of transaction or any drug dealing or any drug use or anything occur with Mr. Spiller or anything else. To turn to the remand situation, we did not cite Page in support of the idea that Spiller may be out by the time a post-conviction occurs, but for the sake of judicial economy. If this were to go before a post-conviction, and we are arguing that the same issue, that counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this issue, the determination of whether or not the cannabis was raw or burnt still needs to be discovered, and that the factual basis will still not be there, and we would just be in the exact same scenario. So for judicial economy, it makes more sense that we address the issue now so that we can get the record fully fleshed out for that argument to be made, so that we can have all of the understanding.
If we were to agree with you and remand the case back, are you suggesting then the trial court would have to conduct a first prong inquiry on remand to ask the defense counsel what he knew and why he didn't file a motion to suppress?
I would argue instead that just the question of whether it was raw or burnt, because as you and the state are suggesting, if it were raw, it would be suppressed. And if it were burnt, it would, or no, if it, I apologize. If it were raw, it would not be suppressed. And if it were burnt, it would be. Then that is a very important distinction that would be indicative of the outcome of whether or not it was. And also,
so the
there's
first,
nothing in the
record.
The
first prong of the Strickland test should just be overlooked.
Well, there was nothing in the record that indicated any sort of plea deal was in process. And by the time we went to trial, they said they were ready for trial. So the risk of getting rid of a possible plea deal is no longer on the table. So it was no longer an issue trial counsel needed to consider.
Time's up, counsel. I want to mention, I thought both of you did a very nice job in oral argument, and particularly Ms. Heckel, I asked you a bunch of tough questions, and to your credit, you responded appropriately, and I thank you for that.
Thank you.
With those words, then, we will take this matter under advisement, render a decision in due course, and stand in recess.